It's below 10% response rate, the first email. You know, if you do a good job of following up, you can, I've heard of people getting it up to like 20, 30% over time. Wow. Response rate. I would love to tell you I like have a super sophisticated answer to what my data was, but I didn't honestly do a great job of building that much of sort of a tech stack around my process. And
yeah,
that's a piece of advice.
There's an entire generation of Americans who no longer care about prestige, titles, work travel, fancy offices, and lunches. Welcome to Mundane Millionaires, a podcast for this generation of small business owners who want to set their ego aside and focus on what matters: family, community, quality of life, and cash flows. In each episode, Eric Pacifici and Kevin Henderson uncover what it takes to get a little money in the bank, control your time, and invest in building great families and lives. Let's get started.
Eric, welcome back, man.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Oh, just always, always a pleasure to talk to you. Always a pleasure to talk to our guests.
Where are you calling in from today?
I'm at home, man.
So, home is
Coppell, Texas.
Do you want everyone to know where you live? Are you worried about that at all?
Not particularly. My address.
No one's coming to Coppell.
No one's coming. Our sleepy little town.
Sleepy town full of guns and mischief. So
you're not wrong.
Guns and misery.
Speaking of guns and mischief, today's guest, I'm kidding. Today's guest was Chris Williams of System 6. He was a good friend of the firm, good friend of ours. We've known Chris for a long time. Full disclosure, our law firm, our other business, we use System 6 for bookkeeping. Just really like Chris and what he's building. But what was
your takeaway? This is a little awkward because I talked to him beforehand and he described you as an acquaintance. So, maybe I shouldn't have told you that, but here we are. Great conversation with Chris. Chris is incredible, right? And he's got great perspective for perspective. He's got perspective for prospective business buyers. He acquired a business in 2020 and has now been running that business for 3 years. Really good business. He came out of one of the elite MBAs and decided to not go the traditional route like most of them do, and instead went the self-funded search route, and talks about, you know, why he chose to go that route. Yep. So that's, I think that'll be of interest to maybe MBAs, but also, you know, I think the vast majority of us have to be self-funded searchers, so it's a little bit more applicable anyways. Yeah. He's been running the business for a couple of years, talks about the challenges of adjusting to running, some of his scariest moments. And then Chris ultimately has really good perspective on the entire ETA, entrepreneurship through acquisition ecosystem, the community. He's at all the events. He's, you know, promoting System 6, but he's also got those natural relationships. And he's one of these quintessential MBA guys that just like it is brilliant, but also like personable and a great networker. So he knows everybody and he's able to kind of open up at the end and talk about what he thinks is going on in ETA, what he thinks about buying a business in an industry where you don't have direct experience like he did with accounting. So I think overall is a great, very helpful conversation. Kevin, what did you take away?
Yeah, I mean, your last point here, I think, was pivotal for me in this conversation. You know, Chris, even different than other service providers like ourselves who really only see a glimpse of the life cycle of these businesses as we're kind of closing the deal, Chris has the unvarnished truth, right? In running financials. And we obviously can't get into specifics over concerns of his business and his client's business, but generally he has a portfolio of data where you can't really hide how things are going over time for the way these businesses are running. And so it was super fascinating to hear his thoughts from where he sits and working with so many, you know, search clients who are now running their businesses, and just how kind of excited he continues to be about this space. And you know, the way he says it and what he boils it down to is the people. You've got young, hungry entrepreneurs that, regardless of how things are going in the business, are tenacious and they're going to fight tooth and nail to grow these businesses. And he sees that play out every day in the work he's doing with his clients. I thought it was really great insight from Chris and his kind of unique position.
Yeah, and I think we should double click on that, right? Because he says in the interview that he has $180 million in revenue from search businesses within his firm. And again, he respects his clients. He did not talk about his clients. But Chris is an intellectually honest guy, and he's also aggressively going after search clientele. And if the sector was not performing well, if these businesses were not performing well, number one, he wouldn't be trying to after those clients. He'd be pivoting away from those clients. Yeah. But number two, I suspect that he would be running around going, this isn't a good idea. So a lot to be discerned from reading between the lines in this discussion with Chris. So a great interview and no surprise with Chris.
Absolutely. I think, once again, I think I say this every week, but I think our listeners are going to love this conversation with Chris. Super valuable insight. Enjoy
our friend Chris.
Chris Williams.
Enjoy our friend Chris.
Our acquaintance, Chris Williams. With that, we will catch you guys on the next episode.
Jack, it's the Christmas episode.
Exactly. It's Christmas colors. We'll give them to you, Eric. We'll round up. It looks like, you know, red and green to me.
Should have broke out the Santa hat to kick off, since we have Chris Williams in the studio.
Yeah, hey, Chris.
And by studio, I mean remote from his own office.
From my own office, yep. I wish I was with you guys in, I don't know, is it Texas or is it Florida? Where's
no one HQ? Really knows where HQ is at this point, Chris.
I get a lot of questions about whether or not I'm moving to Texas, and so let's just squash it right now. I will never, so long as I live, move to Texas. I love Texas, and it's a great place, particularly before you have kids. Tons of great food, tons of fun things to do. But Central Florida, baby.
I can't wait for that comment to not age well. When Florida's underwater and you're begging to sleep on my couch while you search for housing in uptown Dallas.
What does Dwight tell Pam when they lose the key? And she says, well, what happens if like something happened to you, Dwight? And he goes, if I'm dead, Pam, you've been dead for weeks. Okay, so.
That's the reality. I'm going to say something real controversial, and Kevin, I know you're in my camp here, which is screw Texas, screw Florida. I'm in California. We're never leaving.
Let's begin with this. So we got Florida. I'm in Florida camp. Kevin's in Texas camp. So actually, one of my most successful tweets of all time, it depends on how you determine success, but was this off the cuff just joke with a beautiful picture of Key Biscayne that said if Texas and California had a baby, it would be Florida. And it was like, you know, talking about the business climate and the weather. And man, did people get angry about that one.
People outside of California love to rip on California. And people inside California love to rip on all other 49.
and everywhere else. That's also Texas, interestingly. Yeah. Though most Texans who rip on everywhere else generally don't go anywhere else, which I find ironic.
I've never left. Yeah.
At least Florida and California have some statistics to support our value system, our beliefs. Texas is just out there going, we got our own statistics. We're our own country. Okay.
I love how you make these comments as if I'm going to defend Texas.
Yeah. I'm staying out of this one. There's too many small businesses in Texas. I don't want to piss off. I'm staying out of this.
It's a great state for ETA.
The culture.
Joking aside, Texas, Florida, California, they're all, I mean,
yeah.
People shit on California. They shit on taxes. I do a lot of deals in California. And Chris, you did your first deal in California.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Remote business, but I am in California and I got to stay in California, which was, I wasn't searching for a remote business, but I was looking for a business that would let me keep my life here in kind of the Western US. And obviously buying a remote business is like the perfect version of that in terms of not having to move a mile to run my business.
I think we can all agree that it's the rest of the 47 states that suck, and we're kind of the
we got it all figured out here.
We got something to argue about. So
let's go.
But Chris, let's dive in, man. So you were a searcher out of Stanford MBA program, and decided to go buy a business. This was a couple years ago. So this was what
2020. So I mean, I can just jump in and kind of rip you through my search story if that's helpful. Like, should we start there?
Let's do it.
We can, but actually before we do, Chris, let's pause for a second and if there's anything you want to plug, talk about System 6, talk about anything else, let's do it at the beginning so people are actually listening.
Yeah, 100%. Well, yeah, thanks for that. So I bought a outsourced accounting sort of finance back office business. So we do sort of day-to-day finance operations for small businesses, bookkeeping, payroll, bill pay, invoicing, controllership reporting. We're kind of not doing CFO forward-looking. We're not doing taxes. And yeah, acquired small businesses ETA has become a huge channel for us. We're now serving over 40 sort of search fund acquired businesses. It's like $180 million of revenue that we see through the search ecosystem. We've had a lot of success serving those clients well. And I would also say, like, our team loves it. And this is a shout out to the ETA community of, like, everybody we work with for the most part is, like, high energy. They're working hard. They treat their service providers well. They want to let us do our job, which is modernize and sort of automate their finance operations. So kudos to the ETA community for being good people. And yeah, we love serving them. So if you're out there and you run a small business, like, we'd love to serve you. And by the way, you don't have to have bought it. That's how a lot of people come to us. But if you run a small business and you don't want to do your bookkeeping, your payroll anymore, give us a call.
Well, I was going to say, so just to contextualize, you said about 40 or so search clients. How does that compare to the broader portfolio?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have 170 total small businesses, but it has become, like, this year, 75% of our growth has come from the search sort of acquired ecosystem. You know, and some of it is, hey, we signed Rich Jordan a couple of years ago, and now he's referring us a buddy who maybe didn't buy a plumbing business but owns one. So it's like, where do you attribute it? But yeah, it has definitely become the vast majority of our growth, which we love. You know, we're going to try and build some other verticals as well. But I think you guys are building a kick-ass business in the space. Like, it's a great
place. Well, and we talk about the same thing too. And people are like, so how much of your business actually comes through Twitter? And it's like, well, at this point, and we're even younger than you are, we're only a year and a half in, but that would be hard to contextualize, right? Because certainly a lot of deals come through DMs, but tons of deals come through Chris Williams and Rich Jordan, right?
Yeah.
The same type of people who are referring clients over, but the relationships we have with those referral parties have come largely through this ecosystem. So it becomes murkier and murkier. I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah. I think it's like, you just got to, you know, try and corner the market through going to conferences, Twitter, podcasts, like, do everything. And then, you know, that way you're in front of everybody one way or another.
No, I love it.
I love the way you characterize searchers, though, because I tell people all the time, I'm like, there's two phenomenons happening here. One is the great wealth transfer and the quote unquote silver tsunami that I think is real. And I think we're all kind of seeing it. But the second and more interesting phenomenon is that business buying is not a new thing. But what is new is the type of person that's going and buying these businesses, and having somebody like yourself out of Stanford and many others out of Wharton and Harvard, and, you know, long-term corporate guys and gals, really successful people that in the past would have gone to Goldman, McKinsey, you know, Wall Street, you know, more traditional paths, but instead are going, you know, in many cases to the middle of nowhere and buying these businesses, and they're high energy and they're excited and they're revitalizing. And I think that's so cool. And part of the conversation that we don't have enough is how exciting it is to have these people, instead of going to Silicon Valley or into, you know, into some soulless institution, going back to Main Street and working on roofing and HVAC and plumbing and commercial cleaning and, like, revitalizing, pouring talents into these communities, I think is super cool. And I think it'll pay a ton of dividends in the next couple of decades.
Yeah. And I mean, like, we see it in our clients and some of the interactions we have with our clients' employees. You know, it's not always just like the owner, maybe it's the office managers or sort of general managers that we're working with, is like, yeah, the previous owner was obviously built a great business, but they've usually, like, taken their foot off the gas the last couple of years, right? They're cash flowing, they're getting close to retirement. And yeah, they didn't make that investment in, like, whatever, you know, to stay in plumbing HVAC. Like, they didn't go buy Service Titan because it just, like, wasn't worth the money. And then now you've got a new owner who's growing the business again. So they're providing growth opportunity. They're making it a better place to work because they're modernizing benefits, all this stuff. Like, it's not all just, you know, hey, I'm going to go make a ton of money and sell it to private equity. Like, you're hopefully, you know, making these better places to work by growing them. And that's, you know, a better option than the alternative for a lot of the team members, which is, hey, they are going to sell it to maybe, you know, a consolidator who is going to make some layoffs, or they're going to close the business down. Like, you know, sometimes they don't, they either sell or they close it down. So there's a lot of good that I think happens for the team members too, not just the, you know, entrepreneur who ends up making millions of dollars, hopefully.
All right. Well, Chris, we're 9 minutes in here, so let's get after it, man. Let's dive in hard into your search process and your buying process. You're 3 years in. And I think for a lot of people, 3 years is a, you know, an interesting time period to stop and reflect.
Yeah.
And to look at the buying process, look at your biggest challenges, the, you know, the, and then to say, hey, after 3 years, would I do this again? So let's start by talking about the search process coming out of Stanford, buying a small business. What was that like? How long did it take you? And what did your search look like?
Yeah. And I think, you know, to pull the headline up front, like one of my most important learnings of the search process is like, look, there are 5, 10, 15, 20 different ways that you can go about looking to buy a small business, different structures you can use during your search at the acquisition. And I think that like, it's kind of, you got to really figure out what you are solving for. And that's really important to do up front. Cause I actually, it took me a few months to solve for it. And that's why my journey is a bit, or took me a few months to figure it out. And that's why my journey is a bit weaving, and I'll get into that. But, you know, I think, hey, Twitter sort of says there's one way to do it. Business school says there's another way to do it. Like, I think the most important thing you can do is spend a couple of months looking at the multiple paths and really evaluating for yourself which one makes the most sense, because there's somebody in every camp that'll tell you it's the best path. And the reality is, like, no path is the best, in my opinion. I mean, I have my biases, but take time to look at all of them. Anyways, so my journey.
Let's pause for just a second, Chris, because multiple paths. You're talking about the distinctions between traditional search, self-funded. So what are the paths as you see it?
Yeah, and there's more. So traditional search, you know, that's historically been coming primarily out of the business schools. Harvard, Stanford, you know, probably 5 years ago, where we're, I don't know, 75% of searchers were coming out of. Now a lot of other business schools have started to build ETA programs. But the basic concept is you're going to raise, you know, if you're an individual person, $400,000 or $500,000 to keep your lights on for 2 years, you know, pay yourself $125,000 salary plus or minus. You're coming out of business school. You may have a couple $100,000 of loans. So you need some income to take care of that. And you also need some cash to travel and pay legal fees with broken deals, et cetera. So you're basically raising money up front. And to the tune of $400,000 to $500,000 from 10 to 15, usually sort of small institutions that invest exclusively in search funds, and individuals who usually made all their money through a search and selling it. And they are going to be your advisors, mentors. Eventually, they'll be your board of directors when you go buy a business. The pros and cons of that path, like, you will own up to 25% of the equity. It's a pretty standard set of terms. You know, you have a board that truly could fire you. So some of the critiques you see out there, like in, you know, in the Twitter ecosystem is, hey, you're going to own, you know, way less than the majority of the business. You're going to have a job because you have a board. My perspective on both of those critiques are like, look, yes, some people have been fired as CEOs by their search boards, but it's very rare and it's usually like warranted. And then, yeah, you're going to own a smaller piece of the pie, but it incentivizes you to go buy a bigger business, you know, $2, $3, $4 million of earnings. And there's a lot of value of buying bigger because you get more scale out of the gate that you can go reinvest with. You know, that model is definitely more like you're swinging for the fences. You're going to own less. You're going to have to go buy a bigger business. But if you do it right, you know, those are the searchers that you hear who make $20, $30 million in 4 or 5 years because they like absolutely crushed it. Of course, those are, you know, the outliers, but that's kind of the traditional path. I would also say, you know, yeah, there's like I said, there's kind of benefits to scale. It's not just about the size of the pie. So that's traditional.
One of the things I like about traditional too, Chris, is it's a little bit more of a well-worn path, right? And it's reserved for, in most cases, like your elite MBA, you know, that's not accessible to most people. You know, because that group of investors, which sometimes are referred to as like the investment cartel,
It's a mafia.
They're giving you search. They're giving you money to go search for a business for a 2-year period of time. That's risky. So they really reserve it for the Chris Williams and the other high achievers of the world. But it's more of a well-worn path. If you can do it, I actually like it because go cut your teeth. Well, you've got a board. You've got a, you know, a great group of people. You go buy a big, hearty business. You've got guardrails in place. And then after you have that exit, whether it goes well or not, you are a, you know, supercharged individual to go do something different. Yeah,
totally. And I think there's a lot of value to having a board around you during that time. Yeah, to make you a much better operator over those 4 to 5 years, you know, even if you don't hit a complete home run. And yeah, you're right. I mean, historically, it's been, you know, the basic idea they came up with 30 years ago is like, hey, let's take really talented people, you know, for better or worse, how are they evaluating talent? It's just, did you have these, you know, 10 jobs that allowed you to get into these fancy business schools, or were you special forces in the military? Like, that's the investor's shortcut to evaluating talent.
Did
right?
you they're kill not, people like, in Kandahar? Then we will give you our money.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, I was surprised how quickly, when I would have conversations with these investors, they tell you like, oh yeah, I'd love to invest in your search. Like, they're just using, you know, these schools kind of as their interview process. They're like, hey, if Harvard lets you in, you're going to be good enough for me. And by the way, there's like obviously flaws in that. You know, the business schools are working and trying to, you know, accept more diversity, but it's not their strong suit, diversity of background, you know, diversity of experience. So I do think that some of the traditional search fund investors, you know, they're trying. There's women in search groups now. There's some firms that are more open to mid-career individuals. But yeah, they're never going to like let the 24-year-old, you know, who's an incredibly hungry person, probably raise a traditional search the way that that does happen in the SBA ecosystem, which is freaking awesome. I think in a lot of ways that, you know, you can be 24 and if you've got the cojones to go after it, you can go buy a business. So
by the same token, they're probably not talking to or looking at the 45 to 50 year old, you know, mid to later career professional, which we've certainly seen in the self-funded search side.
Yeah. And does that make you feel sad, Kevin? That's an age joke.
Asking for a friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm 41, and like, damn it. All right.
One of the reasons I didn't ultimately go down traditional search was, yeah, one of the things they want is they want you to be pretty committed to buying a business in a large geography, whether it's national or like, you know, large parts of the United States, because they've seen over time, like, hey, it's really hard to find a $2-3 million EBITDA business. And that's a good business in a good industry. And so like, if you're 45, you've got three kids, you know, you've got the pizza community cornered in your market and you can't leave like Windermere, Florida, right? Like, they're like, how many businesses are there for Eric to go find? So
we're going to have to bleep out. We're going to have to bleep out Windermere though, because there's bad blood. Anyways, we didn't get up. So let's pause.
Orlando.
I think, yeah, greater Southwest Orange County. I think we did a good job of describing what is traditional in that path. Let's talk about what you did, which is self-funded.
Yep. And then there's some paths in the middle that I'll hit too, but.
And we can be a little fast. Most people know what self-funded is, but yeah, go ahead and give us your take on it.
Yeah. I mean, just quickly, it's, you don't raise money during your search to buy a business, which gives you more flexibility to what you can buy. Generally speaking, people who self-fund their search are trying to maintain more control in what they buy. And that often comes through the form of using the SBA as their source of majority capital. So you can get up to, you know, a $5 million loan. You have to personally guarantee it, which is a very real thing you have to think through. But these loans have very attractive terms. The bank's willing to lend up to, you know, 70, 80, 90% LTV given the 10-year period. It allows you to buy a business with not a ton of equity down, which means the investors let you keep a lot more of the business if you even have to end up raising money. You know, some people have enough savings and they're buying a couple million-dollar business with an SBA loan that they can put the 50, 100 grand in themselves, and then they own it all by themselves. You know, I do think there's a nuance in self-funded, which is, hey, like literally all self-funded searches is you self-funded your search. You didn't raise money during search. Yeah. You could go find 3 million of EBITDA and end up doing an independent sponsor deal, or go raise money from the traditional search community because you really want them to be your investors and your terms will be a little bit better. But I do think, like, just because you've self-funded your search, don't cap yourself and only look, in my opinion, only look for deals in the SBA ecosystem. You know, you can go bigger if you find it. But yeah, the average person who does a self-funded search is going to buy something, you know, $3-7 million purchase, use a large loan from the SBA, and own the vast majority of that business, which is pretty compelling.
Yeah. We don't want to get into like confidential deal points, like, you know, what you paid
Yes, we do.
But give me the cent. What was your funds flow? Break it down line by line. Can you contextualize, for example, like based on your investor group and stuff, like how much of your business did you keep, you know, and sort of what was that structure like in your search as you
And I'll say really quickly. So when I, you know, I came out of business school, I knew I wanted to do a search. I had a couple of investors that I'd met during business school who actually primarily do traditional search that I really liked. And I had said to them, hey, I'm not going to do traditional search for a couple of reasons. I don't know exactly yet what I'm going to do. I may want to raise a holdco in a few months. That was super hot and sexy. It still is. But hey, will you be my sort of mentors and advisors?
We actually call those baby Berkshires, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, we're all, I was just like, I'm the baby next Warren Buffett. Like, just baby give me Berks. The money now. But the point there is like, I was just like, hey, can we talk every couple of weeks? Will you guys be my sort of mentors, advisors? And they were like, sure, we get to support you while you search without having to give you money up front. That's like a better deal for them. And anyways, so, you know, I eventually realized I didn't want to do the holdco thing. I really got into this because I want to run a business. And if I need to buy more down the line, then I'll raise more money then, but let's not over-engineer it. And then yeah. It was full-time search. So I did raise about, you know, when it came to my business, I acquired it. I raised 10% equity, you know, outside capital. And, you know, most of that came from these investors that I've been working with the whole time. And then I raised a little bit more from two other people, Sam Rosati in the ecosystem, who you guys know, obviously. And so, yeah, 10% equity, 15% seller note, and 75% SBA loan that, thank God, I fixed for the first 5 years on my interest rate. Otherwise, I might not be on this podcast. I might be, I don't know, slinging software to try and make my interest payments. So yeah, I mean, relatively standard.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming on, Chris.
Yeah, that's it. Relatively standard structure. And yeah, I own 75 plus or minus percent of the common equity.
And so, how long did your search take you once you navigated that path for the different avenues and decided, nope, I'm all in on self-funded. I just want to find a business to buy and run.
Yeah.
What did that process look like?
I mean, I probably started really searching aggressively in like November, December, and bought this business in July of the following year. So it was relatively quick.
Okay. But
part of the reason it was quick was like, I started working, so to speak, in August of 2020. And I was exploring industries, you know, thinking about, hey, what's my theme of my holdco going to be? And then pretty quickly, you just like, well, if I'm interested in this industry, I'm not going to go raise a bunch of money. Let me like learn if it's good first. And the way you do that is you go reach out and you start talking to some owners. So I was, you know, kind of half searching even while I was doing the ideation phase. And even that was what really pushed me over the line of like, I'm enjoying talking to owners. This is what gives me the most energy, not thinking about my terms and what, you know, the next 20 years of my life are going to look like. So, you know, yeah, I was kind of half searching probably by October, November. So it was a 8-9 month process. Which, if you buy a smaller business like I did.
From beginning search to closing, 8 or 9 months.
Yeah. I mean, I started working in August.
Do you recall when your LOI was inked? How long to actually find
a business? Yeah. So I signed my LOI in April and May, June, July. We closed like, I don't know, 95 days after signing the LOI. But I also bought an outsourced accounting business with very clean books, you know, no heavy equipment, machinery, no, very little potential liabilities to go diligence. And so it made it a much easier closing process.
Chris, those are hard to buy though, right? Because it's hard to get a seller to take a non-CPA seriously. How did you pull that off?
Yeah. So one thing, so I did a primarily direct outreach, sort of people use a fancy word, proprietary search. I didn't spend a ton of time on brokers. I really felt like one of the most important things that you can do is buy a business from a seller you have a ton of deep trust with. And I felt like the best way to build a lot of trust with a seller is to kind of get to run more of your own process versus going through a broker. So one, that definitely helped. And then two, like you got to get lucky in search. And this business, it's an accounting business, but actually wasn't owned by a CPA either. He was an entrepreneur who started it because he realized it's a good industry. You know, we don't need to be CPA owned because we don't do taxes. So you know, yeah, like I sent this guy a cold email and got lucky enough that he responded. And when we first talked, Jeremy wasn't quite ready to sell. And then he had a personal tragedy that sort of made him want to spend more time with his family more quickly. And that's like, you got to hang around the hoop and search. You hear people talk about that all the time. Like if you get on the phone with a seller and you have a decent conversation, just follow up every couple of months because you might get lucky where their circumstances change.
What did the email say, Chris? Do you remember?
It was, so I was low volume, like real email was my strategy. There's some searchers out there who are sending thousands of emails a week. Yep. Mine was just very much like, you know, hey, Jeremy, something that I wrote based off his LinkedIn that was like a real hook. I should go find it. And then I'm, you know, have worked in finance in my career. I'm interested in buying a business in this industry because I think it's, you know, a big growth opportunity. And I know the recurring revenue model is very attractive, like something specific that showed I knew a little bit about the industry. And then just be direct. Like, I'd love to talk to you if you're interested in selling. Not like this whole, I'm going to cherish your legacy forever. Like, we get so many of these. Like, just be a human. Yeah.
That's got to be, that's my favorite line, you know, yeah. Tongue in cheek. Cherish your legacy. Cherish your legacy. Yeah. I feel like we need to create a fund like the Cherish Your Legacy Capital. Or
There's there's a lot of websites out there that could be roasted for sure.
Trademark pending.
Probably mine included. But, yeah. I mean,
What was your hit rate on that sort of outreach? I mean, obviously that led to what you ultimately bought, but I'm curious how many, you know, proverbial door slams were there in this cold outreach process?
Yeah. I mean, it's below 10% response rate. The first email, you know, if you do a good job of following up, I've heard of people getting it up to like 20, 30% over time response rate. I would love to tell you I like have a super sophisticated answer to what my data was, but I didn't honestly do a great job of building that much of sort of a tech stack around my process. And as a piece of advice, like I just wanted to get going. So I was just like firing emails off directly for a little while and then trying to remember which ones to follow up with. And it's like, take a week, set up your email system so that you can be a little bit more data oriented around your outreach if you're going to do direct outreach.
But I mean, the flip side is also true, right? Because some people will hear that and they'll take 6 months to set up their tech stack.
Yeah.
And there's also that piece that's like, just start sending the damn emails, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's a balance. Also, you know, like, don't wait for perfect.
I don't know that I agree with that. I agree, guys. Especially, Chris, so you said you did a limited, you know, very specific search in your geographical area, and you only get one opportunity to make that first impression. And so, it's hard for me to...
I wasn't suggesting make a bad impression, Eric.
Well, no, I mean, obviously, Kevin. But I want to hear more concretely your thoughts on this direct outreach campaign and then navigating a off-market transaction, because from November to April is no time in search life. So it's hard for me to sit here and go, oh, wow, Chris just got really lucky. I mean, it sounds to me like you approach this very intelligently. Now, objectively, you're an amazing, you know, if I'm going to sell my business to somebody, a young, energetic, nice, handsome dude who's coming out of Stanford MBA that lives in the area, like, yeah. You know, that's a great person to sell my business to. So you had that going for yourself, but
for sure,
certainly you had to not fumble the bag. So tell us about your perspective on mass mailing versus kind of that more specific outreach. And then when you get that bite, how do you land the fish? Because I'll tell you 80% of my fallout in my process, and Kevin, tell me if you see it differently, it's off market deals. It's trying to navigate the process with a seller without the broker there to grease the wheels. And that's really hard.
Yeah.
So tell somebody who's listening, how do they pull that off?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'll just kind of walk through the whole process, why I started with that sort of that more focused outreach philosophy. And look, it's not me like inventing the wheel and coming up with something very unique here. Like, this is what a lot of the traditional search community investor base preaches, is like, not brokers, you know, do direct outreach, build a real relationship. That's why you need to have a 2-year runway, because it does take longer. You're going to have broken deals. But I mean, my perspective was, like I said earlier, I really wanted to buy a business from someone I could have a lot of trust with. And I felt like that doing direct outreach was going to be a big part of that, because it would give me more of a timeline. And then I think what helps is my North Star in search, and what I tell searchers now, even before that seller relationship, is like, you got to buy a business in a good industry, because you cannot change that. Like, the industry you're in. Even if you buy the business from a shitty seller, maybe you can overcome that if they've got good lawyers like you guys. But once you're in an industry, you're in it. And so my philosophy was like, pick industries that I think are good, that I'm interested in, have done a little bit of homework over them. So yeah, when you do reach out to this person, like, you know, and I see it now in my business. I don't know if you guys get these emails, but they're getting so many emails that are just clearly mass template, so many direct mails that are clearly mass template. So like they're going to react when they see a human, and when that human like shows them some level of thoughtfulness and knowledge and some level of like, hey, they've actually done some real work ahead of time. So that's where the industry focused direct low volume outreach works, because, you know, you get them to open the email because they see it's real and it's personal. And then you make a good impression because you've actually said something about their business that shows a little bit of knowledge. So I think that's what got me in the door. I mean, what Jeremy said was like, yeah, I've got a bunch of these emails, but I could tell you were real and I could tell you knew something about the industry. And then you have to look for signs, like, because Eric, you're right. Some of these off-market deals, they're either never a real seller and they never were, or they don't ever put the right people around them to get a transaction done. So like I had signs from Jeremy that he was willing to sell. Like he, you know, at first when I talked to him in November, he wasn't. And that was like, all right, let's stay in touch. But then he came back to me, something bad had happened. He had some offers from other people. He hired a broker like to sort of facilitate the process. So when I talk about like getting lucky, it's stuff like that, that he had some other offers. He decided to hire a broker, which made the process a lot smoother for sure. And I think, yeah, I mean, honestly, if you never get to meet the seller's spouse, like that's a very important thing relatively early in the game. Like go spend time with the seller, take the seller and their spouse out to dinner, ask the seller's spouse, what do you think about the business? Like a classic question, like what are you guys going to do in retirement? And if like the partner, spouse, or even the seller doesn't have a good answer, then you can tell they haven't really thought through it and they're just playing you for a number.
They're like, we're going to compete with you, Chris. I mean,
yeah, 100%. Like, I mean, there are some real things you got to look for. Yeah. If you just like think you're going to get somebody off the street, convince them to sell their business, that's pretty unlikely. Like they need to want to sell. And it just happens to be that you got to them right before they got a broker involved.
And even then, when you get the timing right, were there points during that 90 plus day deal process where you had to claw this deal back from the brink where you thought, no, this is not going well, this is going to blow up, and you had to triage?
Yeah, 100%. And it was like classic rookie mistake made by me, which was putting a couple of the existing employees had sort of phantom equity in the business. Mm-hmm. And it was very important to him that they sort of got to maintain its very small percentage of the ownership going forward. And I was like totally supportive of that. I thought that was a great idea. And I put it in the LOI, but I put it in, you know, fancy private equity terms that he misinterpreted. And, you know, I don't know, 30, 40 days before we were supposed to close, he kind of realized what he was expecting me to do around that equity was very different than what I was expecting. And all of a sudden he felt like he didn't trust me anymore. I had to recover from trust. And that was just like great lesson to learn of, in my case, I'm buying a business from an accountant who knows a lot of this stuff already. And yet I still kind of over-engineered it in the document. So just put everything in layman's terms is like super, super important. Yeah. And if it can't be in layman's terms from a legal perspective, then like talk to them and explain what it actually means. Like the whole working capital thing, you know, address that up front. Don't wait until the 11th hour to try and jam that through. Or, you know, hey, if the seller has debt on the business, like remind them they're going to have to pay off that debt. Yeah. And, you know, like those types of things that we think are obvious sometimes aren't. That was probably the biggest rocky point for sure, was how, and it was, you know, how he felt like there was some trust eroded. And luckily we had built a really good relationship. I had spent time with his kids and his family before, so I was able to recover from it. You know, and that's the beauty in these.
You were Uncle Chris. Deals.
There's a funny photo. You know, if we hit a home run, it'll be in the case study one day of like me literally reading a nighttime story to his three girls.
You know, no, like,
oh, that's hilarious.
Do you have that picture somewhere where we can put it up on the screen? Because that's amazing.
I will send it to you. You can get it in there during edit. I mean.
Yeah, let's not put a picture of his children on the screen.
Yeah, I was about to say I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that, but
yeah, that's why you guys are our lawyers. You know the right answer.
Well, no, and two things that I think are so important, Chris, that you touched on is the simplicity, but being complete and making sure you've got a meeting of the minds. and the simplicity in the LOI needs to flow through into simplicity in the definitive agreements. And they can still be deadly. I mean, the terms can still be deadly in your favor. And in fact, the simpler you keep it, the more wiggle room you give yourself to make it really, you know, robust contractual protections. But also, I mean, that having that proximity and you're running a local search, I had a buyer recently who ran an amazing self-funded search. But part of the reason, and I see this over and over again, part of the reason I think he was so successful is he had had a busted deal before. And these guys who have, or gals who have busted deals, they come back like, you know, execution style in their search. And one of his rules for the second search, he had a great, he was in South Florida. He had a great business located in Canada and it fell apart. And part of his, you know, his learning lesson was, I need to be within proximity so I can develop that that relationship and foster that rapport. And so business number two, he said it had to be within like a 3-hour driving radius so I could be there every weekend, you know, building that relationship. And he crushed it in deal number two and he bought one within 3 hours. It's a great business. And shout out to him if he's listening. You know who you are, but I'm not going to say your name for obvious reasons. So that's a great point that you made.
Yeah, like don't forget at the end of the day, and this is why searchers win. Like we're never paying more money, right? Like Jeremy chose to sell to me relative to private equity, you know, because they care about this business. And I kind of think, you know, if they don't care about the business, like if you start to tell during the process they don't care about the business, like that's a red flag.
Yeah.
So like these people built this thing from zero to one, tons of like sweat into it, and they care about who they're selling to and the relationship they can have with the person they're selling to. And like, yeah, so you gotta, whether it's, if it's through a broker and it's a local deal and you can still build a relationship, I think it's really important to like build a relationship with this person, and you got to find a way to do it. 3-hour drive radius is a great idea. You know, if it's a direct outreach, you can probably extend it because you've got more time to work on that relationship. But yeah, you got to build a relationship with the seller, because like if they want to screw you, they, you know, they can really create a lot of headaches. And I think it's really, really important to build that relationship with the seller. Like,
well, and what does that look like today, Chris? So, you know, a lot of searchers that we talk to are either in their search or closing, they're in the months post-closing, so they're in the consulting transition period. You're pretty far removed from your transaction.
Yeah.
A lot of work, a lot of trust, a lot of relationship building went into that relationship. What does that relationship, if any, look like with the seller today? Are you still in contact?
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, Jeremy and I probably talk once or twice a year. I mean, he's got a $1 million seller note in here, so he's got definitely still some financial exposure that he cares about. But it's also, you know, there's kind of a back of the mind comfort knowing like, hey, if something ever really bad happened here, you know, I'd absolutely be able to get him on the phone. Like the worst moment I had in our cert and my operating journey was like 6 months in. It was that first real gut punch of, you know, one of my direct reports, one of our team leaders putting her notice in, and like, yeah, I called Jeremy the next day and was like, what do you think about this? How should I handle it? You know, is it worth trying to save her? You know, and he was out from a transition period really, really quickly, but so I would say it's, look, of course there's deal terms I wish I had negotiated harder on, et cetera, but you're trying to get the deal done, but it's very much now like, hey, if I need some support, he's there for a phone call. And he still refers clients to us. You know, he's an entrepreneurial guy sort of in his community and knows people who need bookkeeping. So he sends them our way. So it's a pretty cordial, like friendly every couple times a year. And then I know if I need him, he's there, which is good to have.
Well, before we move too far on from your actual kind of search and business, you hinted at this, and I wanted to ask you and get your thoughts again with the benefit of several years now. Things appear, at least from the outside looking in, to be going really well for System 6. Yeah. Things are growing, etc. I have to imagine that hasn't always necessarily been the case. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, you know, whether it was that key departure 6 months in, or, you know, something else that happened. Like, did you find yourself at any point after closing, talk directly to those searchers who are going through a tough time post-closing, where you're like, man, this is just not going well. This is a train wreck. I'm really nervous for the future. What did that look like? Did that happen to you? Did anything come up? And how did you push your way through it?
Especially, Kevin, let's put a finer point on that. You bought in accounting and you did not have an accounting background. And that's one of the things that a lot of people are saying.
That's a great point.
It's a big mistake to go buy in an industry that you're not in. What's your perspective?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think first, like, I even before that, like, gut punch moment, and then absolutely, like, buying an industry you're not in, I was on a panel a couple months ago and wanted to say this, and, you know, a search audience, I want to say it here, too, is, like, it's okay to every day not know if it's going to work out and have some concerns. Like, that's the fucking entrepreneurial journey. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but, like, you know, yeah, Kevin, we're doing pretty well on paper, but there's still questions. I think every day in my back of my mind, like, we have big ambitions. Are we going to get that done? You know, we're trying to buy a house right now. That looks differently than it would have been if I had stayed in corporate world. Like, it's okay to have some kind of perpetual nagging. Like, you don't have to feel like it's an amazing thing every single day, but I think there's a ton of value if you can just push through that and understand, like, if you're doing something entrepreneurial, there's, like, fundamental uncertainty. You know, startups get to $1 billion of revenue and they still blow up. So just, like, you got to learn to live with the uncertainty. And I've had to work on that. And that's just kind of like the macro entrepreneurial thing, right? Like, you guys are crushing it, but I'm sure there's still, like, things.
No, Chris, you can stop right there. We're doing great. And that's all there is to it. So next question.
Yeah. You've already made it. You're retired.
That's it.
Yeah. So I would say that, just like as an overarching statement, I would say, I mean, there's two periods that, you know, kind of come back to me immediately of, like, the rockiest moments. One, it was, you know, that team manager deciding to leave, putting in her notice. You know, the way our business is structured, we've kind of got four or five almost like mini GMs who manage teams of 5 to 8 people. And so when one of them leaves, that's very disruptive to that pod. I mean, I literally remember, like, that was like the most sleepless night I've had. It felt like getting dumped in high school by your girlfriend. It's like a total gut punch the first time something like that happens. And, you know, I mean, I think the way you get through that is, you know, like, owning it with the team pretty quickly, like, not trying to bury it with the rest of the team and say, oh, like, it's this person's fault. Like I said to our other team members, like, hey, she's leaving. You know, I definitely bear some responsibility in that. Like, you guys I'm going to need you to step up a little bit now and manage some more people until we go hire a replacement, and just being real, you know, like, shitty things happen, and acknowledge that it's not great. Like, you know, own that with a team. And then I think that's better than trying to, like, sweep it under the rug. So from a management perspective, like, that's how we reacted. I also think having people to call, like, thank gosh, I had a good relationship with my seller and had investors I could talk to about how do I handle this. And then I also think that, like, look, everyone's going to get punched in the first 6 months. So, hey, like, maybe don't use max leverage.
That happened in the first, you know, 6 months, like, that you had that departure?
Yeah, that was even less than that. Maybe month 5. And that was, you know, if I lost 3 or 4 of those team leads, I'm in real trouble. Because, can't jump into the work that they're doing, to your comment earlier, Eric, of, like, I can't deliver the work that we do. So, you know, how do you get over that? Like, I'm a big believer in buy with enough scale that hopefully you're, like, one level removed, or, you know, two levels removed from the service delivery, so that maybe you don't have to go jump into it. And also, I don't know, just, like, I tell, don't worry too much about that. I mean, tons of people have bought businesses and industries they don't have experience in and have done very well. And, like, what do you need experience in is, like, how are you going to sell? How are you going to improve culture? How are you going to make it a better place to work so your employees stay around more? And that can not just be culture, but benefits and modernizing your operations. Like, I think if you're buying a business where you think there's a big chance you're going to get sucked into service delivery, you might not want to buy that business.
So,
talk
to us about that, Chris. Let's say hypothetically.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Hypothetically, you're deep in service delivery of your small business.
I mean, I do think that, like, how did we absorb that? It was like, well, we were an 18-person business where we had some capacity for other people to step up and handle the punch. You know, if I bought a 6-person bookkeeping business and I lost my number 2, like, nobody else can step into that. So it just, there's arguments on Twitter about size of business that you can buy. And I'm a big believer in buying bigger so that you have more ability to absorb stuff like that when it happens, because it will happen.
Yeah.
And don't
when you were evaluating System 6 on the front end, did you have the perspective to look at culture and look at benefits and think about how you were going to kind of improve it from a one level to remove from the product delivery position?
Honestly, like, no, you know, rookie learnings. I was definitely focused on, you know, average client size and how quickly can we grow revenue, client retention, you know, EBITDA margins, like, okay, how many people we're going to have to hire, how quickly to serve the growth I'm going to drive, like all important stuff in diligence. But, you know, especially if you're buying, like, our product is literally our people. You know, we have technology and checklists that we use, but, you know, even compared to like a plumbing or HVAC business, which is still 95% people, at least they've got assets. Like, they've got trucks they can go sell in a pinch if they need to. We don't. Like, we literally just have people. So now when I look at add-ons, it's very much like, what's the quality of the culture? What's the quality of the people? Because that drives our business. And I'm lucky that I think I bought, you know, and it shows up in the numbers. So I think I had somewhat of a sense that there is a good culture here, but I'm lucky that I bought a good culture. And I think what I've done is really tried to lean into it and just make it more of a focus point. But I think, you know, if you're buying a business that's a very people intensive service business with a really crappy culture, like, that's hard to change. That's hard to change quickly. And you might, you know, you might want to stay away, because again, then they're going to leave really quickly and then you're not left. You don't have anything.
Let me ask one more question about the business. Much is said about the idea of kind of getting into the game, right? And once you're in the game, you know, magic happens. Yeah. And one of my, you know, our good things can happen. One of my favorite buyers, and I won't say his name, but he bought a small business and then he went on and bought a bunch of businesses, and we worked opposite of him in a transaction, and he was the real deal. And what he would do is, off market wise, he got to the point where he knew the business so well, primarily because when he bought his first business, it was a 250, 350 EBITDA business. So he was working in it. And you guys may recognize the story, but by the time he had built what he had built and he recently exited, he would walk into a potential add-on and he would need to know like three things, and he'd have that business under LOI by the end of the day. And he would know, and he'd close in a month, and he would know exactly what he needs to do to improve the business. For you, being 3 years in, have you reached that level where you can go look at a tack-on and say, hey, these are the couple of things I need to know? And are those things, if the answer is yes, are those things that you were evaluating when you bought your first business, or are they completely different things now that you have your arms wrapped around the industry and the business?
Yeah, I think 100% yes is the answer to both of those. And I think, also, like, you know, I've been talking about size and I do believe in size, but yeah, I think you can absolutely buy small. You know, I know the story you're talking about here, but also, like, then buy small with a structure that's going to work, right? Like, you know, don't have like incredibly burdened, you know, SBA loan where you have no room because, you know, you just need to be able to absorb things, or you want to grow the business, it's going to cost money to grow. So think about your capital structure when you're doing a deal. Just make sure you have some cushion, and it's not just percentages and multiples. It's like, how many dollars do I have to play with, or how forgiving are the lenders going to be if things start to get a little hairy, or if I decide I want to invest more money to grow. But to answer your question, yeah, for sure. It's not revenue and margin numbers anymore. It's like a level deeper. So the things for us that are really, really important are now like average ticket size by customer, like monthly recurring revenue per customer, and employee retention. And it's not just employee retention, it's like employee retention over a certain period of time. Like, you know, there's a lot of people that, and we have this problem of like not quite getting hiring perfect. So we have a decent, like, high churn in the first 6 months, and something we're working on. But then if people make it 6 months past, we have very, very high retention. So like, I ask sellers to sort of produce not just overall employee retention metrics, but like, I want to see how long they've worked there. And then that allows me to figure out like, hey, if they make it past a certain period, is the culture good? And then they stick around. So it's kind of, yeah, those metrics of sort of client size, I care a lot more about now, because I realize that has to do with stability of the end business, employee retention, because if you don't keep your people, then you're not delivering a product. And then, you know, customer retention as well. So like, you know, I used to care a ton about gross margin and EBITDA margin, and I still look at that, but, you know, you can move some stuff around to make those numbers look better. It's more like, get to the fundamental unit economics kind of the business. And that's you only want them operating.
And I love the average ticket size one. I'll never forget our discussion with Mitchell Baldridge, who's a related field, but you know, tax accounting, and talking to him about scaling his business. That, and Eric, keep me honest on the numbers. I don't remember what it is, but shrank his client pool by like 80% or something, while, you know, some multiple X-ing his revenue. Like, just,
he cut his,
you know,
he cut
really his, he cut really honing in on
1/4, and he 5X his revenue. And that was primarily because of the power of social media. But yeah, fascinating statistic. Yeah. And also,
yeah, this was an amazing how you segment. Grow it.
Amazing segment. It's a bummer we have to cut the whole thing because, you know, Chris Cust and Kevin, you brought up one of Chris's competitors. So we got to.
Yeah, we're back. We're back to just talking about Florida and Texas. But
it's one long bleep.
You know, I do think, and Eric, we talked a little bit about, you know, hey, we both running professional services business. Like, we haven't had that crazy level of Mitchell story, but we, you know, we're adding the same number of customers in 2023 that we added in like 2020 and 2021. It's like 35, 40 customers a year, you know, 3-4 a month, but it's a 50, 40%, you know, more revenue added this year than in those years, because we've taken our average ticket size from like $18,000 a year to $29,000 a year is I think what our number is for the year. And especially like our ecosystem is exposed to AI, you know, your ecosystem a little bit exposed to AI, like it's a leverage tool, but I feel like, hey, the more you can go up market, do more services, the harder it is for, you know, AI to nip at our heels and steal our customers. So I think in professional services, going up market is a good thing to do.
Yeah. For those not watching the video stream, you actually don't realize that the Eric Pacifici participating in this interview is AI generated.
I did want to just take a moment to say that the AI is doing a wonderful job. I'm a big fan of the AI, an ally of the AI. So
whichever AI has access to my bank accounts, you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Eric is not really the Signet. A figment of the imagination. What's the line from American Psycho? There's a concept of Eric. He's not a real person or something.
Yes, I'm. Yes, absolutely. Chris, so let's pause here. We talked about your business, your search. You have visibility in a number of interesting ways to the ETA community, you know, both through System 6, which we won't talk about out of respect for your clients, but you know, more broadly, you're at the conferences, the self-funded search conferences, you're at the school conferences, you've got a lot of great relationships. You've come from kind of the traditional world, but you're kind of more, I think you're participating maybe a little bit more in the self-funded world, given what you chose to do. ETA, where do you think we're at? You're 3 years in, is it a good idea? Are people doing well? What's your vantage point here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I think the best thing is how many more people just know about ETA in general. It's no longer gatekept by the business schools. And I mean, candidly, Eric, like, and Kevin, you guys have a big role in that, which is getting it more visibility online. But like, when I went to business school, I started in 2018, I'd never heard of a search fund. And now there are 24-year-olds going to do searches. There are people who come to business school knowing that's what they're going to do. And so the proliferation of just like knowledge about search is one, I think, a huge trend over the last couple of years. And then two, there are a lot of different models popping up. You know, there's holdcos popping up. There's search fund accelerators popping up. There's, you know, structured support for self-funded searchers. So I think just the additional resources that are available are fantastic. Like, it used to be, if you wanted to do self-funded, you're like completely on your own. And that's changed a lot in the last couple of years. Where do I think we are overall? I mean, I think there is a little bit of a risk of like people falling in love with a reality from 2012 to 2021 that may not be what the next 10 to 15 years look like. Like, a lot, especially in traditional search, a lot of people that made a ton of money, you know, bought on-premise software businesses for 5 or 6 times earnings, they converted it to the cloud, and then they sold it for 5 or 6 times revenue and made generational wealth in 4 years. Like, that's not really happening anymore. You know, it was a great time to buy a business in 2012 or 2013 and sell it in 2020 or 2021. And like, you know, that is what drives a lot of the multiples that you see. So like, yeah, I think that you know, people talk about the Stanford search study and look at average returns. I would bet over the next couple of years, those down, but I still think it's like a fantastic opportunity, which is if you buy a good business and, you know, and a decent, a good industry, and you pour energy and growth and grit into it, like it will be bigger and better over 5 or 6 years. You know, will it be like multiples are changing, the interest rates are different, et cetera. So like there are some macro things that might not make it the amazing thing it was before, but like at a high level, I think it's still a very, very good place to be. And like we have 40 search fund clients and pretty much all of them are growing, you know, materially. You know, some are still in their early days, like working through some seller dynamics, but the ones that we've seen who are a couple years in, I mean, they've done some add-on acquisitions, like it's still working in real time, right? The people who bought in 21 and 2022, they might not get that multiple trade that people did kind of over the last 10 years where they bought for 4 or 5 times and sell for a lot more, but you can still grow your business. And that's what this is at the end of the day. It's not multiple arbitrage. It's like buy a good business and grow it. And that's definitely still happening. I think, you know, yeah, like I said, most of our clients are growing, you know, probably 10% plus on an annual basis.
What's the reality for a lot of these folks in kind of building the holding company? You know, they all call us up and they're their first acquisition. They're like, you know, I want to get set up for the holding company. What does that really look like in reality? And how fast are people actually buying multiple businesses and having success?
I mean, I think so if it's a industry specific holding company, which might just really be a roll up, that's happening. I mean, there's some traditional searchers I know who bought med spas, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. They bought $1 million EBITDA med spa, and 3 years later they're at 10 million of EBITDA because they bought 5 more and they're selling it to private equity and they're trying to go from 10 to 30 million of EBITDA over the next couple of years. So, you know, we've got some sort of home services businesses that are on their second or third acquisition. We've got a car wash roll up that's on their third acquisition. So I think if you're industry specific and you out of the gate either have a partner or, you know, buy a business with enough scale that you can have a GM, you can get a deal done in the second, you know, in the first 12, 18 months after close. I haven't seen a ton of these like, hey, we're going to go buy 10 different businesses. That takes longer to get the second deal done because a lot of where the second deal comes from is like you're in an industry. Like we get deal flow coming to us, but it's only accounting firms because they know, hey, I'm an accounting firm owner. Chris bought his business. Maybe I want to sell mine to him. So if you're trying to do a hold co of disparate businesses, like I think it's going to take longer than if you're just trying to buy multiple businesses in the same industry. You know, then I'd also say like, I thought I would have done an add-on by now. And part of the reason I haven't is like we bought, you know, I started smaller. So it just like, I didn't have the time to take one down and absorb it. You know, versus some of the people who buy a little bit bigger can do add-ons faster.
Are you open to selling? And are you open to selling to us?
Only to Kevin. I will sell to S&P Law Group if we can carve Eric out.
Let's talk, Chris.
It's like the Fortnite Disney situation. I will sell you my stake in S&P Law for $500 million, and then I will step out of the way so you fellas can have your little role. Yeah, how's that sound?
Yeah, Mike, depending on how you're, you know, hey, if you had 100,000 followers yet,
let me flip the script. Chris, are you interested in buying a law firm? Just asking for a friend in case we can.
I have my grand vision, and I'm sure you guys have talked about it too, is like one-stop shop for small business services, right? Like you guys are incredibly trusted by your buyers. What else can you serve them with over time? Like that's how we think about it post-close. It's not just accounting. Like we should be doing tax. We'll get there over time. CFO, insurance, you know, wealth management. There's a lot of repeat sort of reoccurring professional services that we'd love to be offering clients over time, even if it's through like referral arrangements or kind of, you know, third party white label contracts. Like there's something to be said about being in the professional services space.
Well, Eric, is now the appropriate time to announce the launch of our new bookkeeping service, System 7? Is that...
The 7
trademark bending.
Hey, Chris, how much do you charge? We charged $5 less than Chris, so hit us up.
I love it.
We're going to squeeze him out. He can sell to us, or we'll take him down.
But no, that's super exciting, and it is fun to be in the same place because, I mean, Eric and I are talking all the time, like getting our heads together of, you know, what are the service needs for the space? And I mean, there's such a need for high quality service providers in the small business space. There still is. It's a blue ocean. not on legal. The legal court market is cornered. Nobody else should look at doing legal in this space. But
in fact, you might not even involve a lawyer at all. But we'll talk about that in our next spot.
Yeah, you may just go rogue. But I think that also, like, you know, the cool thing for you guys, for us, is like right now a lot of it's happening in acquisitions. But like all of these businesses, one way or another, are gonna change hands. Maybe it's not an acquisition; it's a son or a daughter takes over, and just like the next generation of people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are gonna want, you know, better, more modern service providers. And I think that's like just a huge, huge opportunity in the space to provide those owners, you know, the next generation, the next generation of service.
So as a professional service provider, as you think about that, and maybe this is where we can sort of wrap up, how much are you focused on developing an improved client experience versus just growing the bottom line? Because this is something we talk a lot about internally with SMB Law Group, our law firm separate from the podcast.
Yeah.
Is sort of what could, because I think that's one of those key differentiators. It's not just, I want to hire a smart lawyer. It's, I want to hire a smart lawyer that delivers a high quality work product in a way that is convenient, beneficial, and helpful to me.
Yeah. And I think the good thing, I mean, so the answer is a lot, but I think the good thing is, like, we don't have to develop the actual product. There are a million, you know, tech businesses out there trying to build client portals and trying to build, you know, modern billing systems, and for us, you know, task management software. And so, like, we don't have to get in the game of building technology, but we are in the game of, like, selecting the right products, whether they're client facing or not, that do allow them to experience service the way they want to. And I think what you said, Kevin, of like providing a better experience for the client is super important. Like, I've seen it happen a ton in accounting. I don't know if it's happening in law firms, but, like, you know, firm owners or employees, like, hear about this new app and they fall in love with it, but they don't stop to ask, like, hey, does the client actually want to interact with this? Or does the client, you know, care about this? Do they want to pay for it? So, like, you have to keep in mind, hey, it's not just what we want to do to make our job easier, but, like, does the client actually want it and will they use it? Like, in our industry, there's been, I think, a huge obsession with portals, and sometimes people, like, are honestly just fine to stay in email, and it's easier for the client versus logging into three different systems. So, but the reality is, like, you guys, you know, we want to charge a premium price. I'm sure you guys don't want to charge the cheapest thing on the market. And if you're going to do that, it needs to feel premium. Yeah. And people have a hard time really evaluating the true underlying quality of the work. So how do you make them feel like it's premium? It's, is it good communication? Is it good people you're working with? Do they have good sound and audio? You know, those types of things, so that it feels like a premium experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I love that and couldn't agree more. We talk about it all the time, and it's funny to hear you talk about the portals because it drives me crazy. But that shoe is on the other foot, right? Where it's like, man, we got to find a way to deliver things succinctly, securely, you know, et cetera. And it's like, is a portal the right answer? If so, which one? Which one are clients going to use? It's tough. It's tough to navigate.
You know, but the one thing I'll say,
we have the benefit of being in an industry where literally no innovation is happening at all. So as a baseline across law firms, we've just decided as a group that we're not going to do anything. So we're still operating in the 1990s. We still have fax in our contact information.
Exactly. So we're actually moving from the Microsoft Outlook ecosystem to Lotus Notes. And that's going to be our.
And then you can take the fax out, move it back to Microsoft Office, and then you'll hit a home run. I mean, that's beautiful. All Purge is. It's just remove the fax, right? Rebuild the website. But the one thing I'll say just quickly is, like, tech is great. But I mean, you guys feel the same way. Like, at the end of the day, you got to hire kick-ass people in professional services, and you got to keep them motivated and keep them around. Like, that's how we're going to win.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Eric? I think you wanted to say something. Why don't you wrap us up?
Yeah, I want the final word. I just wanted to give a shout out. If anybody in private equity or any smart people are listening, the legal profession is ripe for disruption. Don't disrupt us. Come work with us. And Chris, you'll have an LOI in your inbox here before we hang up this call. So
I will be signing it sight unseen. Let's go.
I love it.
Let's roll up everything.
This is my proprietary outreach campaign here. Get you on my podcast. Compliment your hair.
I have heard of searchers starting podcasts in industries they want to be in. You got to have a lot of time horizon, but I have heard of that.
I like it.
Yeah, that's a long play.
I was trying to decide. We were halfway through, and I didn't want to interrupt because you guys were having a very sophisticated conversation. I was trying to decide which of the two of you has the better beard going on. You both have a really strong beard game. Chris got the more traditional.
Chris has the actual beard. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you? Like what is that? Is that a goatee, Kevin?
I would think so. Eric,
is that a goatee?
I'm not a connoisseur of facial hair styles. It's just how I've looked for.
Have you gone beard ever?
No, other than when I'm too lazy to shave.
I would like to see it.
I always end up not doing the beard. I've been intrigued though.
Let's make that a rock. Somebody said,
Yeah, we need the beard. Chris is right. Somebody commented on a picture of you, and by the way, we should take our picture, but somebody commented and said you look like Dan Campbell, the Detroit Lions, and asked me if I was on a podcast with Dan. And I was like, dude, you do. I'm going to put it on the screen for anybody who's.
All right. And we're going to, and as soon as you, I don't know who Dan Campbell is. So as soon as you flash this up, we will know if our partnership is surviving or if you're witnessing the end of SMB Law Group.
You know where I just went? Kevin, I went to Mark McGuire.
Each and every single day, we are witnessing the end of SMB Law, whether we know it or not. It's nothing to do with Dan Campbell. Let's see. How do you spell goatee?
Goat with two E's at the end.
Oh, there you go.
I think I got a better one. Hold on.
Man, Dan Campbell, dude, up in the house. He'll bite your kneecaps. Look out. Kevin, you've bit a kneecap or two in your day.
Dude looks like he's seen the inside of a CrossFit box for sure.
Kevin, you should go watch his introductory speech. So, but I love this guy. I'm a Detroit Lions fan, but I love this guy in particular because the Lions are the losingest sports franchise that exists. They've been in two playoff games since 1957, and they've lost both of them. They suck. And this guy comes along. He's got them sitting in second place in the NFC, which is crazy for Detroit. But when he took over the job, he gave this speech at his introductory press conference, and he was like, we might not be the best team, most talented team, fastest team, but when you knock us down, we're going to get up. And then you'll knock us down again, and we're going to bite your kneecap. We'll get back. And he went through it like four times. He's like, well, I'm going to get up again, and then I'm going to bite your kneecap again. And we just kept doing it over and over again, talking about biting the kneecaps. But he doesn't have this team cranking.
He actually recycled that speech from Chris Williams taking over System 6.
Yeah.
And
yeah, if you don't perform, I will buy it. That's leadership 101. You know, tell especially your remote team when they're meeting you on Zoom for the first time, scare the shit out of them. That's my number one guess.
Interesting. We'll talk about the next time you come on, but having that introductory call with a remote team, like and not scaring people into finding new jobs when it's all remote, that's fascinating.
Yes. I mean, have your seller there to help out is a big thing when it comes back to seller relationship. Like, he had previewed it. He had told everybody before we closed that it was happening. And yeah, also just acknowledge it. Like, I was pretty direct. Like, hey, you know, we're not making any changes. Your jobs are all safe. I'm here to grow the business. Like, because that's the first thing people's mind go to. And
don't let people spend a weekend wondering what's going on with their job. That's like whenever I see Friday closings, I'm always like, Don't let people go drinking tequila that Friday night.
Mark McGuire. I love it. Kevin, you got a little bit of Mark McGuire going on.
I could put a little red in there.
Dude, let's talk about Mark McGuire for a second. Then we can just wrap this up. But you talk about in America, you can cheat and you can be a hero and then you can have your reputation destroyed. But so long as you apologize. That dude got up there, apologized, and everybody moved right on. Like, dude, nothing had happened.
100%. Own your mistakes. There's a Twitter thread in there, right? Like, cheat massively and just own it, and it's fine.
I'm writing it right now. This is not legal advice, but
don't ask for permission. Just cheat, steal, and gamble, and then apologize. You'd be fine.
As long as everyone else is doing it, no one cares, right?
And that's the pod for today. Shout out to the State of Florida Ethics Bar on that note.
That's your good advice from your accountants and your lawyers right there, guys.
Yeah,
Chris, it's a genuine pleasure always to chat with you. Thanks for coming on. I think there's a lot of valuable insight in this episode that listeners are going to walk away with. So really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, guys. Honestly, big honor to be on it. I'm really thankful to be here. So thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Mundane Millionaires. If you enjoyed what you heard in this episode, make sure to follow Mundane Millionaires wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. See you next time.